Well, a double punch tonight. Ancient Artifacts, Ancient Astronauts, Jason Martell joins us, and Eric Parker will join us. Eric, by the way, is the webmaster, the official website for Zechariah Sitchin. So get ready for that on Coast to Coast AM. Let me introduce both of our guests here separately. First of all, Jason Martell is a world-renowned researcher and lecturer specializing in the ancient Sumerian culture, Sumers, advanced technology, how it relates to Planet X, backed by leading scientists from the mainstream scientific community. Mr. Martell has appeared on many television and radio programs. Looking forward, Mr. Martell is preparing to conduct several groundbreaking international research expeditions. His goal is to gain firsthand access to ancient Sumerian artifacts and other archaeological relics not currently accessible to the public. By bringing worldwide attention to these hidden artifacts, Mr. Martell hopes to usher in a new era in the ancient astronaut theory. Our guest tonight on Coast to Coast. Jason, welcome back. How are you?
Hey, George. Thank you very much for having me on.
Me too. I'm looking forward to this. And Eric Parker, first-time guest here on Coast to Coast. By day, Eric is a successful stockbroker here in Los Angeles. By night, he's the webmaster for www.sitchin.com, the official website of author Zechariah Sitchin. Eric began studying the Bible in Hebrew at an early age. By 1997, he began to read and hear Mr. Sitchin, who specializes, of course, in comparative studies of the ancient world. Eric was intrigued by Sitchin's perspective that the key to humanity's past lies in ancient Mesopotamia, which is Iraq, particularly the written descriptions of extraterrestrial gods. And astonishingly, much of the Old Testament seems to be derived from the tales of these Sumerians. Eric's own research was enriched by his several group trips along Mr. Sitchin, including treks to England, Malta, Mexico, Italy. His main focus of study is looking at the first occurrences of themes, stories, language found in the archaeological record, and then comparing them to the historical record. The consistencies between them may reveal our true history. Hello, Eric. How are you?
I'm fine, George. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. I'm looking forward for this. And we'll bring you both in now at the same time, and feel free to jump in at any time. Jason, tell me a little bit the relationship here with Eric. How did you two get to know each other?
Yes. Good evening, Eric.
Good evening, Jason.
Eric and I became good friends while meeting each other on Sitchin lectures. Sitchin gives, or has in the past, given various lectures in key cities, and in the past I used to work with Sitchin in kind of getting his information on the internet, and several years ago Eric kind of took that ball over and has been working very closely with Zechariah. So we're all kind of a happy Sitchin family.
Well, that's great. And I've got to tell you, both of you, that when I first picked up years ago Mr. Sitchin's book, The 12th Planet, absolutely riveting, and I couldn't put it down. He was a guest of mine when I was doing my local show in St. Louis many years ago.
Nice.
And, of course, you know, he's getting up in age now, yep. And he doesn't do as many programs as he used to. But still, his message, I think, is absolutely riveting. Now, there are some people out there who, you know, don't believe in it, but let's talk tonight about these incredible possibilities, if we can. First of all, with you, Jason,
yes.
What's your main focus of work these days?
Well, my main focus of interest is still piecing together, of course, the ancient astronaut theory. But as I've always liked to do, we can look towards a lot of the advances in modern science and compare those to what was written down in ancient times and find the crossover of what's actually the truth. And so some of the latest pieces of evidence that I've been very interested in, some of them not showing up in the news and some of them getting, you know, pieces of release via AP news outlets.
Mm-hmm.
The main thing of interest, though, is in 1996, there was a very hush-hush or not very much publicized NASA experiment that took place called AIRSAR. And this stood for simply Airborne Synthetic Aperture Radar. And it was this big DC-8 aircraft that they attached various radar imaging pieces of equipment to this DC-8 and would fly it over various areas to collect ground-penetrating radar. Now, the reason why this is so interesting as an example, they deployed this again in the mid-1990s. And one of the first places that they flew this over was in Angkor Wat in Cambodia. And then when they flipped on the radar into interferometric mode, they were able to find that just off to the top right corner of the Angkor Wat pyramid was a small unknown mound that had never been discovered.
Huh.
The only reason why they found it was when they flipped on this ground penetrating radar that could actually see depth perception via color imaging to see, wow, there's actually some other large object here that was being hidden by the canopy of the forest. So they deployed archaeologists and proper, you know, excavation equipment to survey that area. Now, the reason why this is interesting is I have a friend who works with the AIRSAR, who is a mission director over at Dryden Research Facility at NASA, and he recently explained to me on a TV show where we were a part of, it's called Prove It, and he was one of the expert panelists that would judge someone like myself to prove it.
Prove it, yeah.
And basically, this gentleman explained to me that they've been doing this synthetic aperture radar over Central America and have just recently found some hidden pyramids there. And this has not even been released to the AP News or is even available on the NASA website yet.
That's exciting.
So hopefully in the next few weeks, we'll start to see some more of this data come out. Now, if anyone is interested, they could type in NASA AIRSAR, and you'll find the AIRSAR website for synthetic aperture radar. And you'll see, as I discussed, like with the Angkor Wat pyramid and the what they call the Kapilapura mound, there's all this false color radar where you can see depth perception based upon color and where they can survey underneath ice, land, canopy of a forest, and find these things just as they've just done in Mexico. And it's a very interesting project that maybe many people don't realize that NASA actually does lend their technology and advances towards archaeological excavations.
Well, a lot's going on these days then, Jason, of course, with this discovery of water on Mars, which we knew about a long time ago, and things like that. Now, Eric, in your case, how did you get involved with being Zechariah's basically webmaster?
Well, George, actually, the first time I heard Zechariah on the radio was on the Art Bell show.
Ah, okay.
And after I heard him on the show, it just rung true to me, and it just reminded me a lot of the things that I studied when I was studying the Bible in Hebrew, when he mentioned the Elohim and the Nephilim and these kind of characters who were usually translated as either gods or giants, or I should say mistranslated over the thousands of years. So I first went to see Zechariah in Santa Fe, New Mexico, at a seminar. I'm sorry, it was at Sedona.
Okay.
That's right, Sedona. And I met him there and met his wife there and signed up to go on a bunch of trips with him. And in the process of going on several trips with him, all the other regular people that went on these tours, because Zechariah was giving tours that were going for, you know, 2 weeks at a time, exploring all over the world and all over the ancient sites that he wrote about in all his books. He wanted all of the people that could possibly go to see the evidence with their own eyes.
Didn't you find it fascinating when you started looking at the Sumerian texts, the way that the Zechariah was reporting on them, of his theories?
Yeah, more than fascinating. You know, when you grow up in a Judeo-Christian background and everything that you have for telling you the history of the planet and creation is from the Bible, and then you read an author like Zechariah that shows you how the Bible borrowed a lot of the stories, or if not most of them, and in some cases copied down the words, you know, word for word, plagiarized in a way. You know, and in some cases they just changed the stories or changed the names or left out very important details. So I was astonished to find so much more material in these ancient tablets that were not included in the Bible. So the story may be one paragraph in the Bible, but in the ancient tablets, it's 10 or 12 tablets.
All right, Jason, would you say that your expertise here tonight is primarily aimed at the artifacts or the civilizations of the past?
Well, you know, the interesting thing about Eric and I, the way we approach, you know, looking at the same topic is Eric, as he, you know, explained there, he comes from a Hebrew upbringing, more, you know, more of a Hebrew-based learning,
right.
Whereas I was raised as a Christian. So we both approach this from the same angle, only he has more of a fascination, I would say, with the wordplay and an understanding with that, whereas, yes, I have really looked to find the actual pieces of the artifacts and interpret them, but they all fit together. The artifacts with the cylinder seals give a cross-play on each other for, you know, what exactly the story is that's being told. And, you know, tonight with the Sumerians, that would be kind of the pinnacle for ancient technology of a civilization that we're still trying to wrap our head around. But there are various cultures around the same time of the Sumerian epic on other continents that have just as much technology that really don't get as much attention, but deserve definitely to be in the limelight.
Sure, absolutely. And Eric, if you would, for the many new people who've come to Coast to Coast who may not be familiar with Zachariah Sitchin, mm-hmm. would you basically give us a capsule of his theories based on his interpretation of those Sumerian texts?
Yeah, actually, it's very simple. When people look at the ancient tablets, and we're talking about tablets that were chiseled or carved in clay or in stone, thousands of years ago, mostly between 2000 and 4000 BC, they tell a very complete and a very detailed story. And these stories can be interpreted as stories of fictitious gods or fantasy, or they can be interpreted as real history. Part of what Jason and I both do is when we're looking at either evidence of ancient technology or artifacts, we want to corroborate something that the text describes, that the story describes. Let's say it says the god flew around in a divine boat, or a shield of fire, something like this. Well, did they also leave behind a visual record? So when Zechariah started to look at all these ancient tablets, and he found not just the textual stories, but the visual record in depictions or carvings or little artifacts that you can hold with your hand, he found that there was advanced knowledge in there. So the story that was told must have been more reality than fantasy. And well, who are we to say that they were not recording their history accurately?
Did he ever express to you, Eric, how astounded he was to uncover some of this and interpret it the way he has?
He has. He once found the little rocket ship, which is described on our website on a certain article, which I will get the title of. By the way, the website is www.sitchin.com.
S-I-T-C-H-I-N.
Yeah, correct.
So many people call him Stitchin.
Right. It happens. But he found this little artifact of a rocket ship in a museum, in the drawer of the museum curator. And he heard about the piece. And the piece, because this museum never had seen anything like that, and of course rocket ships could not have existed thousands of years ago, they thought that it was a fake, well, a fake that was dug up 15 feet, under the ground.
Yeah, yeah.
So Zechariah was convincing enough to tell the curator that there's other artifacts like this around the world, and that's how he convinced them to display it, although they probably display it more like as a oddity and not necessarily as an official rocket ship from thousands of years ago. But Zechariah was able to show this curator that there were pieces in Central and South America which matched in the motif, in the style, in the design, what they found in Turkey. In this case, the little rocket ship was in Turkey.
That's incredible.
And that's, this is a worldwide study. You have to go everywhere to connect the dots. If we're talking about a true story of a civilization in the ancient past that was able to fly around, then they were a global civilization. They weren't just stuck in Sumeria or Mesopotamia. They were absolutely all over.
Well, what's fascinating to me, Eric and Jason, is when you look at the text, when they talk about the collision with planet Earth of another body, astronomers are saying now that the moon was carved out of the planet after a collision with another major body. I mean, it's uncanny that a civilization of thousands and thousands of years ago would even have anything that would be remotely close to what astronomers are reporting on now.
That's true. But remember, they did not create those theories themselves. They simply wrote down what they were told
right.
by those Anunnaki who were their gods. And Anunnaki just means those who've been heaven to earth came.
Who may have been astrological or astronomical witnesses to these events.
That's possible, but some of these things, like the formation of our solar system, goes back billions of years.
Right.
So they may not have witnessed it, but they may have had a keen idea from their viewpoint of what happened. And, the theory used to be that the moon came from actually a piece of Earth. Now, like you said, it's from this other body. But what is this other body?
And where did it go?
Exactly. Well, Zechariah has said that based on the Enuma Elish, the epic of creation in the Sumerian story, it describes what happened to that body, and that body it was caught by our sun's gravity and is continually repeating, going around our sun with an average orbit of 3,600 years, not a definite orbit every time, but an average.
Do you think this planet, this other planet, is still inhabited?
Well, there is several possibilities. Everyone has commented to me, and I've received a lot of emails. First of all, this planet would be very cold on the in the above ground. If they existed at all and survived, they would have to live below ground near natural heat sources, and they would have to be very good at trapping their energy into their atmosphere.
Yes.
And that's kind of the theory of why Zechariah thinks they came, which was to harness
the
mine
gold,
yeah. Use it as a dust form in their atmosphere and spread it to retain heat.
All right, Jason, you have done some work about ancients and their knowledge of flight. Let's concentrate on this for a while.
Sure.
I find this to be absolutely fascinating.
Well, yeah, it's an awesome topic, and Eric kind of segued in there, too, with the rocket ship. As an example, you know, I would lead in on saying that archaeologists today, when they find artifacts like an ancient rocket ship or some type of artifact in a Sumerian culture that shows the distance between the planets or is showing an Anunnaki with wings, they threw all of this into what they would call a myth pile, or just basically disregarded as saying this is mythology, information coming from a culture that is their mythology. If it's some little guy in a cloud or in a craft in the sky, since they obviously didn't have that technology, what they assume is that this is their myth. As a great example, though, we can see even in modern times how ancient people would have viewed technology, where right after World War II, when the U.S. flew to remote parts of like southern Africa, mm-hmm. and found tribes that had never been exposed to the white man or to technology, white man flies out over, in a biplane, lands, gets out of the plane and has voice recorders and lighters. To the tribes in Africa, these are gods. They didn't understand. So the white man leaves, and they make straw models of the biplane.
Right, what they saw, exactly.
Correct, and they start worshiping this model plane, scraping away the runways, and hoping that this what they perceived to be gods would come back. But it turns out all over in various cultures, they've left us this type of information, and it really has gotten very specific with special artifacts and explanations for what they were seeing at that time. I mean, if you're an ancient person living in a clay hut and using stone tools, you're not going to be able to understand or explain to someone an anti-gravity aircraft or a space shuttle or even a biplane for that matter.
Have you ever seen that tablet from Abydos in Egypt?
Yes.
Unbelievable. Now, how do you explain that?
You know, I've seen that, and I've tried to get other people to give me a comment on that. And what people, if they see an airplane or a helicopter or something that looks like the Millennium Falcon, they don't have a blinder on. But sometimes a person cannot see that because that would destroy their whole whole life view.
I mean, I see a helicopter. I see a submarine on that tablet.
I see it, too.
Yeah.
For a while, too, people were actually, when those images first surfaced on the Internet, people actually were picking them apart and saying, well, this is Photoshop fakery. These aren't actual hieroglyphs. This can't be possible. But, in fact, they are there. And in other parts, in Egypt, for instance, there was in a tomb in Saqqara, they found, I believe it was in the early 1900s or late 1800s, they found what was at the time dated to be a wooden bird model, and they stored it in the basement of the Cairo Museum. It was then rediscovered by a Dr. Messiah who studied models by ancients and said, well, look, to me, this looks just like a modern-day airplane. And various other artifacts, yeah. From other cultures, like Eric mentioned earlier, in South America we have other airplane models that literally look just like a biplane. Now, on display, they're considered to be insect models. Yet anyone that would look at this from the standpoint of what we're showing, various samples from other cultures, a combined realization of some type of knowledge for the power of flight.
Well, now, what if, and let's answer this when we come back from the break, what if these weren't extraterrestrial visitations, but that we had advanced civilizations on this planet, Earthlings, who somehow blew themselves up millions of years ago, tens of millions of years ago? Let's get your take on that when we come back. And get ready to get to the coasttocoastam.com website. Take a look at the types of graphics of images that Jason has sent us, because we're going to go through those again in just a moment. Their website, Jason Martell's website, he's got a couple. They're linked up at coasttocoastam.com, xfacts.com, and ancientx.com. Eric has a couple as well. One, he's the webmaster for www.sitchin.com, and also his own, Eric with K, E-R-I-K, Parker. com. Let's get, first of all, Jason, your take, then yours, Eric, on this possibility that we did not have extraterrestrial visitation, but that this planet has had mass intelligence millions of years ago by Earthlings that have blown themselves up time and time again, and so that the artifacts that we find, the images of planes and a lot of the things that you've sent us here, Jason, that we'll go through in a minute,
that
is based on really Earthlings who just had a very sophisticated society at the time.
Well, that's a very, you bring up a good point, George, that has kind of fascinated my curiosity over the last couple of years. I haven't really been able to pinpoint it as thoroughly as I have towards the Sumerian culture for saying, here's the evidence. But I definitely do see a pattern of what you're hinting at, and here's what I would say. All around the world, for instance, like the pyramids at Giza or the huge megalithic stones at Baalbek, or even in South America, like Pumapunku, we have these huge megalithic stones that have been quarried from miles away and stacked perfectly or positioned in astral archaeological sites, you know, positioned towards the stars and stuff, where the immensity of some of these spots, some of these stones, literally can't be explained. And it just it doesn't make sense to rest them on the shoulders as cultures such as the Egyptians or the Mayans or the Toltecs for explaining some of these sites. And the reason why I say that is when we look at the stories for an Atlantean culture and the evidence to show in other texts like recorded by Plato and such that there was some type of advanced culture that did exist, that if this is true, if there was some type of an Atlantean culture, they obviously would have spread out to the other continents, and these megalithic monuments are a great sign that might have just been the case.
What is your take on that possible theory, Eric?
Well, it's reasonable to think that there have been several civilizations and epochs that have risen and fallen through the thousands or millions of years. Unfortunately, though, the textual evidence, the actual stories, don't fit that hypothesis, because the texts do describe specifically travels from where they came from their planet to ours.
That's true.
It did explain that when they got here, they established a redo of the first city, home in the far away, and they made canals and they built irrigation ditches and harvesting and cultivation. Now, that was done a second time after the Great Flood that we've all known about. They had to rebuild. But the first time, they describe all the detailed work of what they did. And then the text describes several hundred thousand years of these ancient characters or gods working and then eventually getting upset with their conditions and revolting, necessitating the need to create a workforce. And the workforce happens to be us nowadays. So the stories do not match the theory that it's always been humans.
Absent the Sumerian stories, might then you have accepted the possibility a little better?
Well, we still have the stories that each of these ancient teachers from the sky who came after the flood to reteach civilization. There are some cases where the evidence would indicate that it's possible, but there's other cases where there's a direct connection, like the Dagon tribe in Africa that knew about Sirius A and B.
They're New Guinea, I believe, yeah.
You know what I've realized, George, after all these years of research into this kind of material? I realize that Earth has been always visited. We've never just been alone, you know, without anything going on. For some reason, it seems to be that this planet is interesting.
It's a gorgeous planet. I'd visit it if I were an extraterrestrial.
Right. And if it's been habitable for millions or even tens of millions of years. Now, I'm one of those people that believes the universe is infinite. So I believe in infinite galaxies and infinite potential civilizations. I don't think we're, by any means, there's a small number around in the universe. There's nothing rare about us.
Several times I've tried to give the coordinates that Zechariah pointed out in the 12th planet of where this planet Nibiru may be on its 3,600-year elliptical orbit.
Right.
But they can't seem to find it.
Well, One factor is that it comes in from the southern hemisphere. And it tends to be that most observatories or telescopes are actually in the northern hemisphere. Another thing is there are verified sightings in some of the ancient tablets in about 555 BC, where where the story that Zechariah tells is that they witnessed this planet being in a certain constellation. So based on an observation of 555 BC or so, Zechariah sort of predicted where it was going to go and where it was. But I think the accuracy got better after the 12th planet was written. And he also had worked with a professor, Harrington, an observatory who was later on killed, and that professor, or that astronomer, was trying to research the planet and thought that he had located it. But obviously his work was discontinued when he passed away.
Interesting fast blast gentleman from Scott in Raleigh, North Carolina, who says the Abydos hieroglyphs in Egypt are on what is called the Wall of Time. He thinks that these hieroglyphs are scenes and predictions of the future, not of things that were there at the time. And that's interesting.
Well, that's a theory.
One comment I'd say on that is that, you know, in that same area, we have a crypt in Dendera that also shows reliefs what some have questioned to be, you know, light bulbs. And, you know, modern archaeologists say, well, this is just a depiction of an eggplant.
Right.
But, you know, I recently did an on-camera, you know, experiment with the Discovery Channel where I recreated the Baghdad Battery, which in the same time of the Egyptian culture having what they have inscribed on a wall, which presumably could be a light bulb, you'd need a power source. And in that same time frame, we have, which is well known, the Baghdad Battery. And I was on camera able to generate at least 4 positive volts from just one battery. So a lot of these technologies that are displayed, without full understanding or without written text saying we plugged it into the socket and it turned on, there's a lot of these reliefs that are, you know, open to interpretation.
George, the Abydos reliefs are just one small example of when in my own lecture I show over 10 or 12 different rocket ship or ancient rocket ship type pictures.
Sure.
And so it's very, very common to see that motif. There's a tomb of Hoi in Egypt where there is a above ground and underground depiction of a rocket ship in its basically in its silo, and it shows wear and tear, and the bottom shows people doing maintenance and conducting cleaning with the hoses and stuff, and that's a very accurate, if that's the future, that's a very accurate
fiction
writer.
I would love to know who the predictor was. Now,
yeah, exactly.
For those who want to see this image, by the way, the NighthawkZone.com folks have up there at their Nighthawk Zone banner, on the left-hand side, you will see the tablet from Abydos there. You'll see the plane on the left-hand side, something else that either looks like a whale, I think more of a submarine, and then underneath it, an obvious UFO-type craft. And then underneath that appears to be another plane, maybe a helicopter. It's an incredible, incredible piece of work. It's mind-boggling. Jason, let's go to the coasttocoastam.com website. You have given us some images that I want you to go through again. You've mentioned a few of them already, but now that we're seeing the pictures, let's pick it up with, first of all, what some thought might have been a bird in Egypt. That sure looks like a plane to me.
It does, and we commented on that earlier. And, you know, in the series of a couple other images that are on there, you know, you can see the similarity of what we were talking about earlier with the pre-Columbian versions, and then we have these Egyptian versions of what archaeologists at the time either labeled as a bird model or an insect, clearly to us could be interpreted as a flying craft. You know, another area of our archaeological significance is, you know, the tomb of Pakal, which has been reported as
Lord Pakal, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
I have a picture of that on my website. And him being, you know, seated, what it clearly looks like an astronaut seated in a space capsule,
yeah,
you know, blasting off. They say he's descending into the underworld, or, you know, there's a lot of interpretation of what modern archaeologists would leave out, any piece of evidence pointing towards the extraterrestrial hypothesis.
Yeah, he's obviously sitting in some kind of machine. It could be a time machine. Who knows?
But you know what, George? There's more details in that depiction than most people discuss. You'll notice that his nose is hooked up to a breathing apparatus. And if he's dead, why does he need to be breathing? His head is being supported really properly if you were going to take off on your back. his hands are working levers or something. And I've even seen von Daniken show in a presentation exhaust and rocket fumes coming from the bottom of that little that guy's little chamber that he's in.
What if they just put him to sleep while he travels in space?
Hibernation?
Yes.
It's a great theory. But they were depicting Pakal, how he lived. In other words, it's interesting. If ancients are going to go through all the work, and this, by the way, this coffin lid is over 6 feet long. It's a lot of work. And they went through so much effort to make specific detail and depict it as close to accuracy as they could. Why would then somebody say, well, it's just made up? Maybe they just observed what they observed. It's not for us to change the thinking or the intent of the artist or the art workers. We simply have to see what they left and say, is this possible in our realm of understanding? And actually it is.
Throughout history, we have had so-called teachers from the sky, Jason.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Will these teachers ever come back?
I sure hope so. You know, an interesting correlation with, you know, where I've put my focus on with the Sumerian culture and their gods, which they called the Anunnaki. And we have, you know, various wall descriptions and carvings of how they depicted the Anunnaki. And an interesting similarity is that cultures that come out of South America, right around the same time frame, for instance, the Toltecs, you know, turning into the Mayan culture, this whole culture was renowned and revered for a god that they claimed had long flowing white hair, was pale skinned, and had dark blue eyes, known as Viracocha.
Yeah.
And then in preceding cultures as Kukulcan. Mm-hmm. And why this is so amazing is that if you look at all the South American people, they're dark skinned, yet their god was a long, white haired, flowing, pale skinned, blue eyed figure.
Who obviously wasn't from their neck of the woods.
Exactly. And so the reason why, you know, it's really interesting is that this culture has amazing, they were almost, you know, obsessed with astronomy and accuracy of time, speaking of the Mayans. And this splinters out into various other cultures in South America, but specifically with the Mayans and their various sites like Chichen Itza, which I believe Eric has visited.
I have.
You know, we see the sites just being completely aligned with astronomical points. The pyramid of Kukulcan is actually a three-dimensional calendar. There's 91 steps. It's a four-sided ziggurat pyramid with 91 steps, and that equals 364 days in a year, with the top flat platform equaling 365. So it's actually a three-dimensional calendar. And this is the same type of, you know, accuracy in architecture that we see, for instance, in the Egyptian pyramids, where the type of accuracy and precision really can't be attributed to an ancient culture of 2500 BC unless they were using some type of advanced knowledge that had to have been passed to them. And that's exactly what they say is, this information was taught to us by Viracocha, or Kukulcan.
Well, in the case of the Great Pyramid of Egypt, it's actually a model of the northern hemisphere of the Earth. It has a scale ratio that's one of those precessional numbers. And precession is one of those funny things that you have to be very advanced in mathematics and astronomy to figure out. And we do find evidence of precessional knowledge in these ancient tablets. And you see evidence of precessional knowledge in the construction of the Great Pyramid. But you would have had to see Earth from the air to know. You would have had to know the size of the globe.
Well, and that's where, like, Eric von Daniken comes in with his Chariots of the Gods theories.
Yeah, that's ancient astronauts' theory. It's the same thing, I think.
Dogon tribe, by the way, is in West Africa. I said it was near New Guinea. It is not.
Mm-hmm. You know, speaking of Eric von Daniken, just a quick note that I would bring up. There was some very interesting findings in Peru that really, like, never get news headlines. Anytime we hear about Peru, it's kind of infamous with the Nazca lines in Peru, which are in and of themselves very interesting, because any tourist that goes to Nazca and flies over the lines there, you see the El Astronauta. It's this huge, you know, glyph of a humanoid figure waving at you, and these are only meant to be seen from the sky. But an interesting part in this vicinity is that there's other, let's just say, artifacts that have been discovered, and these have really only been classified by Eric von Daniken, where there's these large geometric diagrams in the mountains just south of the Pisco Valley. And these diagrams
You can only see them from flying over with an airplane, but they're very, very large in scale. We're talking about over a mile in circumference, where when you first look at this from the sky, it's a large, like a square that has a circle drawn around it that's meeting each of the four points of the square. And around the circle, there are little grid points on the outer perimeter, like markers. And when you look at this just one circle, if you circle up higher in the plane, bringing more into perspective on the ground, you see that the geometric diagram enlarges to actually have three sets of circles with repeating 33-degree angles. And really, no one has ever covered this or asked what these were for, but in that same area, there's a weird stretch of these band of holes as well that's found in the Pisco Valley. And these can actually be found by looking at the coordinates through Google Map and Google Earth to actually zoom in and see that these anomalies are there in the mountains.
Eric, let me ask you, and then we'll get your take on this too, Jason. Do you think these visitations by ancient astronauts are what drove religion on this planet, and that all religions are based on an inaccuracy, and that inaccuracy is we were visited by extraterrestrials, maybe Adam and Eve were extraterrestrials, and religion has it all confused now?
Well, yes and no. What happens is this. The oldest occurrence of an event is recorded. But after that original occurrence is recorded, each individual culture takes the stories and changes the names and creates a whole thing around it. So you have an ancient set of stories that is the predecessor of all the ancient Judeo-Christian religions and some other ones as well. But what each group does with it was their own destiny. So some of them are, if the original event was a misidentification of an alien ancient astronaut sighting and something that happened, a close encounter,
mm-hmm.
and they wrote it, you see, George, they wrote it the way it was. They didn't say that these were gods. The original mistranslation of their word for these sky, these people of the rocket ships, was mistranslated to the word God the next time that language changed. And that's part of my specific research, is I look back for the certain words and where those origins of words and other ideas come from.
Yeah.
And so if it starts with a misidentification and you keep running with it, everything's going to be inaccurate.
You agree with that, Jason?
I do. And I'm sure Eric would touch on this as well, is that, you know, when we look at the Sumerian culture and the various stories coming out of that and translated by people like Samuel Cramer and, of course, Zachariah Sitchin, mm-hmm. the explanations for the gods coming here and why they were here, you know, in the first place, there's a lot of interpretation for, for the meaning behind that. And as an example, you know, when we look at the depictions of the Anunnaki, we see wall reliefs that depict them as, you know, with a beak or having wings, just like we see in the Bible, angels being depicted with wings. But did they actually have wings? Is this something they were trying to symbolically tell us, or were they actually trying to depict something they saw? And as a reference, when we look at, for instance, when we first sent, you know, astronauts to the moon with Apollo 11, we say, Houston, the eagle has landed.
Right.
And we give, you know, the Apollo 11 patch as an eagle landing on the moon. Of course, we weren't landing birds on the moon. We were just symbolically saying that they had the power of flight. And a lot of these stories that we have from the Sumerian culture speak of a time when man lived amongst his living gods. Just like in the Bible, it says there were giants upon the earth.
Mm-hmm.
The Sumerians speak of a time when they carried out practices and rituals that commanded by, let's say, a high priest and you know, recorded by a scribe would be taken over and over again as things to follow. But when the gods leave and the priests are left to follow these rituals, who do they turn to for guidance?
We'll be back with Jason Martell, Eric Parker, in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with Eric Parker, our guest, Jason Martell as well. Eric, back to some of the works of Zachariah Sitchin, if you would.
Mm-hmm.
The Anunnaki that Zechariah talks about, do you believe that they were evil?
No, their intentions to them were very positive and moral and noble. How it feels to us later, it could feel maybe not evil, but certainly harmful in many mm-hmm. ways. But they didn't expect what they got. when the stories describe how when they first created the human race, there wasn't a lot of them. But then they really propagated very easily, and they were very noisy, and they complained a lot, and they kept the god Enlil awake at night. And the god Enlil, opposing the god Enki, Enki and Enlil were the two sons of Anu. Enlil really was more negative towards humanity, and Enki loved humanity. And so one of them is the, Enki is the character that in the Bible tells his favorite human Noah to build an ark or and save his family. In the Sumerian story, that's Enki. And Enlil's the one who tells all the other gods to be quiet about the impending disaster so that they don't warn the majority of the human population.
Yeah, they want to wipe them out, didn't they?
Well, that was his decree, and he was the boss. But Enki violated the decree, and he called his favorite human, whose name was Zeusudra. And then in a later text, it became Atrahasis and Utnapishtim. All of these names are the same character, the Noah from the Bible, who survives the flood.
And interesting on that note of the flood tablet, because I'm staring at it here right on my screen as we speak, is there is a tablet actually stored in the British Museum that's called the flood tablet.
Mm-hmm.
Now, is this the Noah's flood, or is this a different one?
This is, well, that's the whole thing, is that this is a tale that, as it's told, is that, you know, British archaeologists doing excavations in Iraq, one of the assistants to the curator, a gentleman named George Smith, uncovers this Assyrian version of the Old Testament, which is basically a derivative of cuneiform
mm-hmm.
script, and it's explaining, you know, the same version word for word, you know, in this much earlier version. And he, you know, this curator George Smith, and this is in like 1872, he, you know, throws his hands up in amazement and freaks out, because here we have first hand knowledge that a biblical tale is being found in an actual stone version, which is thought to be possibly in its original form.
George, the interesting thing about the Noah's Ark story is that the Bible actually copies word for word a certain statement that's in the Mesopotamian version. That is that after Noah's, they come out of the ark and they build them a sacrifice and they cook, God comes down and the Bible says that God smelled the pleasing aroma. That's a direct copy from the Sumerian tablets, which says the gods smelled the fragrance, the gods smelled the pleasing fragrance.
Charred flesh, yeah.
So they're copying that word.
Charred flesh.
But the thing is, the creator God of the Bible should not be interested in meat being cooked and smells. But that characteristic of that previous god from the previous culture's story stayed in there. And many things like that occur, where certain forms of the stories, they had to keep a certain statement or a certain way of saying it. And those old references are how we know that it was actually the same story that was in the Mesopotamian version is the one that the Bible uses, but they left out a few details.
Why did they leave the planet? What happened?
Well, Zechariah talks about a couple things. First of all, there's tablets that describe how when the grandparents came down to view the grandchildren and visit them, the grandchildren were older than the grandparents. Because according to Einstein's theory of relativity, the farther away you are from a gravitational source, the slower time will feel for you. For these guys who were on a planet with a very long orbit, they didn't age as fast as we do zipping around the sun every 365 days.
Mm-hmm.
When they came here after several thousands of years, they started to become subjected to our time frame. And so the grandchildren started to become older than the grandparents. So some of them left because they would have died. Some of them actually chose to die here. Zechariah and I have been researching, and we're trying to get to the British Museum to see some remains of a princess that was found in the royal tomb of Ur.
Well, and what do you think about this?
Well, her headdress is in Philadelphia in the University Museum, and the headdress is really big. It's a really big head. But the remains in the British Museum, we have to go through the formal procedure of requesting it and justifying why we want to look at this very old set of bones.
You mean abnormally big?
Well, we don't know for sure. We don't have any specific measurements. All we have is the headdress.
Huh.
And other artifacts. By the way, in that same tomb, they found a little model of a ram with its horns caught in branches, which is part of a story that turns out with Abraham before he sacrifices or attempts to sacrifice
sure.
Isaac.
There also, if I would quickly interject too, is when we get too far about why they left, also in coming here, there are seals that actually explain and depict, for instance, the creation of the Adam, Mm-hmm. Not Adam and Eve as in the story in the biblical tale,
right.
But a sense of an actual creation of a worker.
Genetically manipulated.
Correct. And what's really interesting on the scientific side of this is that even Time magazine did an issue in saying that roughly 300,000 years ago is when the mitochondrial DNA shows up for us in southern Africa. And we're talking 300,000 years ago. That's the genetic sequence that matches the Homo sapien that we are today. That mitochondrial DNA is passed inherently by the mother only. And so it can show a genetic track record. And it turns out that the information bequeathed by the Anunnaki is in the same time frame of when they originally came here to Earth and found out that there was this large deposit of gold in southern Africa, which they decided to start mining. And in doing so, in this process of mining, they found out that it was a great toil. They didn't like mining the gold themselves. And this is why they decided to create a worker, a primitive worker. The first version, I believe, is called a Lulu-Amelu.
Mm-hmm.
And this is just a very interesting tale that comes into play where we get the whole explanation for, one, why the Anunnaki originally came to Earth, which is because they said they destroyed or were destroying their planet's atmosphere, Nibiru. Their planet Nibiru was
right.
Where the Anunnaki came from. So they came here seeking gold to repair their atmosphere. But the interesting part of that is, yes, throughout time, man has revered gold. You see gold, you hold it, it's something very precious to us. Why? So over time, all of this information starts to be put into a context for why the Anunnaki originally came here, why they created us, and their whole view on what our purpose was to them.
Do you believe that this era, this civilization, the Anunnaki, may have had the most profound effect on our planet?
I do personally, yes. I mean, since we can't really see any other culture like we were discussing earlier for an Atlantean, some type of advanced technology or culture that's spread across the globe, there is no pinpoint for anything more advanced that I can put my hands on as a reference than to say that the Anunnaki were actually living beings here that existed. Another thing I'd point out, too, is just like those descriptions of Viracocha and Kukulcan, you know, fair skin, long flowing white hair, blue eyes. When we look at some of the descriptions of the Anunnaki, there could be some correlation, especially with the time frame for the exact same era of 3000 BC of when the Mayans started and when the Sumerian culture came about. There's this cross parallel for all the advanced technologies and agriculture and astronomy that come out of both of these cultures around that same time.
Well, there's no question that something occurred on this planet a long time ago. It's been recorded. What about the interpretation, Eric? What if Zachariah's interpretation is different? I think it's Mike Heiser who doesn't agree with
it. Yeah, well, I've had a debate going with Michael Heiser. My agenda is to spread more knowledge and have people do the research on their own and come to their own conclusions. Other people have different types of agendas. There's some specifics, George, that we could talk about, but overall, the general theory, most often when I hear from people how they feel, Zechariah's material really opens up something for them and makes them want to do more research into their own culture, which is how my search started, to find out where I'm from, which is the question of really where we all are from. We look for the first occurrences in history in the written form. What makes the Sumerian evidence so compelling is that there's almost a million tablets that they have found. And they're all the same as the original scribe wrote them because they're in clay or stone. It's not like on parchment where you can have a miscopy. This is the original we're looking at. And also in the ancient empires, every time they conquered an empire, from Sumerian to Akkadian to Babylonian, Assyrian, they would copy all of their ancient texts. So we have versions of all these texts in different cultures and different languages and slightly different names and thus. The evidence is overwhelming that these stories and this information is the predecessors to our own, to our religious views and even more. I mean, I'd like to ask you a question, George, if I may.
Yes, go ahead.
Did you ever wonder why, well, when you go to the baker or you go to buy donuts, how many do you buy?
I don't buy donuts.
Okay, how about bagels?
I don't buy bagels.
Okay, would you buy a dozen?
Let's Well, yeah, let's rephrase the question. Go ahead.
Okay. Have you ever wondered, for example, why there's 60 minutes in an hour or 60 seconds in a minute?
Yeah, I've done a little of that. And back to your other question, if I were to buy, I would buy a dozen. If somebody said, go to the store, George, buy us some donuts, I'd buy a dozen.
Okay. Did you ever wonder why it's a dozen when we all have 10 fingers and 10 toes?
No, no.
Most people don't even think about it. That's the kind of questions that I had. Why is it a dozen? Why is there 12 calendar months? You know, why is there 12 tribes of Israel, 12 disciples of Jesus, 12 Olympian gods? Why is this recurring 12 coming all the time? And the answer actually is pretty simple. The Sumerian mathematical system is called sexagesimal, which was anything was divisible by 6, and then they multiplied 6 by 10. So anything was divisible was always even numbers and very easy for them to calculate gigantic numbers. They, the ones that came out with the 360-degree circle, which is 6 times 60, and the 24 hours in a day in the olden days that used to be called 12 double hours. Again, 12 came up. When the reason the number 12 is because this Anunnaki religion or their way of viewing the world and viewing their place in the solar system, they assigned an astronomical object to 12 different gods. And they used the sun and the moon and the 9 planets we have that we know about, and they used that extra planet Nibiru. And they assigned one of the 12 to each god. So they had a base that came out with 12, which was obviously 2 times 6. So this numbering system, which affects our time and our way of counting and our calendar to this day, was created by them.
And I'd also continue that sentence with another 12 factoid, which is the 12 houses of the zodiac.
Mm-hmm.
So they were the first ones to divide the heavens into 12 parts and assign for that location, you know, a certain constellation. And people ask, you know, well, how would you know and what was the point of knowing about which cycle you were in? You know, you could basically come out at sunrise and see what constellation the star is rising in front of and say, ah, we are in the age of Pisces or in the age of Aquarius. And there's actually another little tie-in to this is that recently in the news, there's been a device, a Greek calculator, which they called the Antikythera mechanism.
Yeah, it's an amazing device, isn't it?
Yes, exactly. And it's, you know, recently just come back into the news, but it's been kind of mystified by scholars for a while because, you know, they did radar on this and found that it's got 37 or so cogs and wheels all intricately tied together, more complicated than a Swiss watch. But it's thought to have been a very interesting piece of technology used for mainly two purposes. One, for astronomical sightings, where if you're a seaman, you could, you know, plot with this device
mm-hmm.
the positions of stars and, you know, set a course. But it also had astrological data, where it was very esoteric for someone at that time to have a device that could tell you, ah, tonight Mars is going to be aligned with Venus, or your planet sign is going to be in this location, and you know it would be good for you to do this at that time. So it was very esoteric knowledge for someone to be able to possess the ability to say where the positions of the planets are in relation to each other, and that's basically what the Antikythera mechanism did. It had
how old is this mechanism?
Well, it's believed to be around 1,500 to 2,000 years old, but there's no set date on it exactly. There's also discrepancies as to who could have built it in the Greek time frame. One of the people it's postulated is maybe Archimedes, who's a very advanced mathematician and technologist for his time.
I remember him, buoyancy in my physics class.
Yes. So just a lot of the things, again, when we talk about the Sumerians and their legacy of information, that number 12, as Eric pointed out, is really a great pinnacle of looking at some of the facts for everything that we use today, from our time to calendar to the count, 12 in a dozen, 12 inches in a foot, but also 12 planets in our solar system. And that's where the Anunnaki say that they originally came from,
right?
Is from the 12th planet.
Well, yeah, it's actually, yeah, it's like 12 objects.
12 objects,
but
yeah.
See, in the,
celestial
in the,
objects.
In the ancient word, the astrological object, they sometimes use the same term. So it could be translated as planet. Or
and there's, and correct me if I'm wrong here, Eric, but I believe there's an actual tablet that shows the route actually taken by the Anunnaki from their vicinity of the solar system, you know, of where Nibiru would be, as to how they charted a course from Nibiru to actually here.
That's true, Jason. That piece is called the Planisphere, and it's in the British Museum. It's on their permanent display. It's a round disc carved object.
How many past civilizations talked about extraterrestrial visitations?
Which ones didn't? How about that?
That many. That many. Maybe even all of them.
Did any civilization not have gods?
I don't think so. I think they all had gods of some
form. And that's the problem.
Form or fashion.
Because obviously we, you know, in a society of belief in a single creator god, you can't accept that there's multiple other gods. So were the stories true, mythology, or misidentified?
I would say that one piece of that is what we were touching on earlier, is, you know, when we look at why, when the Anunnaki eventually left, for reasons, you know, amongst themselves, different clans having their own rivalries.
They fought.
You know, but it's an interesting point to look at, that there was a whole ritual process of, while they were here, there was, you know, a very sacred ritual that would take place, in that, you know, they would record information from high priests, written down by scribes, and then bequeathed to the people in certain areas of what information was allowed to be told. But this process of taking sacred information from the Anunnaki and having it transcribed into stone was something that became a process that they were used to. And once the Anunnaki left, they have no more process of who do the priests, high priests, turn to now to get their moral information and write down, you know, these sacred texts.
Sure.
So that's when it really starts to go in these directions of my God, your God, because of the various different Anunnaki clans and sects that started making these rivalries happen.
And then let's jump back on our planet, because it's time to leave. I want to talk about 2012. I want to get both of your input on that. An ominous date, of course. I've always believed that something enlightening could happen. Jason, what about you?
Well, yeah, the Mayans are a very interesting culture. And again, their knowledge of astronomy and various other, you know, their trade routes and their culture was very advanced. And we look at their three calendars, the Hob, the Tolkien, and the Long Count, speaking of the Mayans, they predicted in their 2012 calendar, which was based on Bakhtuns, which was 20-year cycles in their Long Count calendar, and the Mayans assumed, that their calendar would repeat, just as everything else does in nature. This is where the point is very interesting, is that they predicted in 2012 that there would be an end to all things, but they're basing this on the belief that their patterns would repeat. And they haven't always been accurate. Here's an example. When Kukulcan Khan left in 1000 AD, they predicted that this Viracocha or Kukulcan Khan would return in a second coming, and unfortunately that never took place, because in 1519 they had Cortez show up with the conquistadors, and they thought this white man was the return of their god, and obviously he wasn't, because they aggressively converted them to Christianity.
Let's continue 2012 when we come back. Jason, you're here. Eric, you're here. You're both in L.A. We should go see Apocalypto. Get your take on that, huh?
Should be an interesting movie.
Yep, absolutely. Back to the Mayans for a moment. I happen to think that when we hit this date on December 21st, 2012, it's going to be a moment of enlightenment for all of us, that it's not going to be doom and gloom. We're not going to have a solar flip, a polar flip, that the sun isn't going to fall down. I just think it's going to be something new and fresh for all of us. Any theories out there that would back up anything about 2012 other than just supposition?
Well, just continuing on what I was saying there before the break, around 1000 BC, actually, I think I might have said AD, from the culture starting around 500 BC, around 1000 BC, their god Kukulcan leaves, and it's predicted in their Long Count calendar, the Mayans were talking about, that Kukulcan would return. And so in 1519 AD, we have Cortez that shows up, a bearded white man, and the Mayans simply thought that this was the return of their god, Kukulcan, and, you know, treated them appropriately. Unfortunately, the conquistadors aggressively converted the Mayans to Christianity and thought that all of their amazing hieroglyphs and codices were the work of the devil, and burned them. And sympathetic priests were only, managed to save four, which are now known as the Dresden Codex. And, hundreds of years later, we find that, people taking interest in this and studying them, one of them, a gentleman named Ernst Fosterman, started to look into these Dresden Codex and was able to decipher these now known prophecies that, say take place over Bachtunes, is what they called it, in their long count calendar. And one of those Bachtunes is in 2012, that there's the end of all things. Now, the only thing that's of interest, really, about the Mayans that should be noted is that they based their calendar and their systems of time on natural rhythms of nature. Just like everything else cycles seasonally, it seemed natural and possibly on the right track that their system of time was based on natural processions of nature. So it's very possible that in 2012, like you say, maybe our technological advances or something like that will aspire us to new greatness. But the only amazing thing that's really taking in place in 2012 is that this is the time of when the precessional cycle is actually switching over, for instance, from the time of, the constellation of Pisces into the age of Aquarius.
Right. But, will this be like a Y2K where nothing really happened?
Well, the end of any epoch or era is always seen as a harbinger of doom. Most of the time there's predictions of big change and calamity and this sort of thing. But it doesn't all come down to a final climax on a single day. So hopefully we will not see the extreme weather and different things we've seen on Earth get worse. But so far what we've seen in the recent years is that with global warming, those weather trends are getting worse.
Oh, the weather is, that's no doubt about that. It's huge. I just came out of St. Louis, where at one point 500,000 customers were without power. They're down to about 50,000 now, but that's been almost a week. It's crazy. And the weather now is severe. It's not like the old days. It's just like every year there's something major that happens that's worse than the year before. I think we were really lucky with the hurricane season this year.
The thinking that we have been the only civilization to come on this planet doesn't allow us to see the evidence, for example, in the Mediterranean, how waters rose and the ancient stories of every culture having floods, that low coastal areas will get flooded. And the water is continually to rise for the last few thousand years, at least from the end of the last ice age. Water levels are expected to keep going up, but at a steady rate. But if there's something significant, an increase of the melting of ice on the North and South Poles, the water levels will increase faster than they think, and things will get flooded much quicker.
Do you think the return of Nibiru has an effect on our weather and our systems?
Well, let me ask you this. Is this 2012 date, isn't this going to be when all the planets are going to be aligned on the same side?
Yes, I think so.
So it's like starting over with the orbital cycles. Everything aligned on one side could do something to a weakened ice shelf that's already weakened by global warming. The impending disaster that Nibiru would bring around, now remember, it's been orbiting around 3,600 years average for several billion years. So it doesn't always cause a problem. Just like this 2012 cycle, these planets have aligned every precessional cycle in the same area, or, I don't even know how many years it is. It doesn't mean it's always going to cause something, but it could.
Well, it could. There's no doubt about that. But I still think, how could you predict this thousands of years ago?
That's right.
Well, one thing on that note, as far as, looking at the effects of Nibiru and having that type of knowledge, how it would help us or how it's helped us, there are a couple anomalies as far as some ancient maps, the Phineas map, and I believe the other one is the Perry Reese map, mm-hmm. that were being passed around in like 1531, and shows the accurate topography of Antarctica and South America, North America, and there's no way that anyone would have. And I should also say that in 1531, this is done on like a sheepskin or a lambskin. There's writing on the side of the map that says that these were recorded from much older sources. So when we start to go back in time, there's really no one that I can put my hands on evidence-wise other than what the Sumerians have prognosticated, you know, as the Anunnaki's knowledge, for who could have given them the type of knowledge to say, well, here's what the topography looks like of your landmass, you know, some large chunk of ice that could drop into the ocean. There are accurate landmasses depicted in this Phineas map and the Paris-Ries map that actually show the topography accurately underneath the ice shelves for Antarctica. So there's no way that anyone without ground penetrating radar, also done from the sky, would be able to have this type of knowledge. Yet we have clear evidence that shows these maps were made from much earlier sources, cited even all the way back to Mesopotamia. So if the Anunnaki actually did come here, as the Sumerians say, and Nibiru having effects on us in the past, just like the flood tablet explaining, I believe actually in the creation epic, you can change me if I'm wrong here, Eric, but we have stories that explain that this is actually why the flood took place, was that the passage of Nibiru actually caused these great catastrophes. And there's actually Sumerian cylinder seals that show, for instance, a man plowing the dirt and looking up in awe, where you can see the sun and a glowing cross symbolizing Nibiru in the sky as it was approaching.
They definitely attributed those disasters around the time of the planet Nibiru. So at least to them, there was a connection. Now, we don't know what the real physics was, but more than likely it had something to do with it.
Yeah, there, of course, has been a lot of speculation in the last few years, which George and everyone here is familiar with, for when Nibiru or Planet X might return. And as we touched on earlier, you know, the work of Dr. Harrington was really a pivotal point in the Planet X research on the modern front, where there really was no talk or speak of a planet 4 to 8 times the size of Earth out there beyond Pluto until Dr. Harrington came on the scene and collaborated on a videotape with Zachariah Sitchin. I believe you can buy this video Amazon.com, or probably even from Sitchin.com.
Yeah, from WinDisc.
Are We Alone? And on camera, Sitchin interviews Dr. Harrington at the Naval Observatory in Washington, and they're comparing notes where the Sumerian Nibiru is coming at a certain plane of the ecliptic, has a certain elongated 3,600-year orbit, and Dr. Harrington is saying, yes, I confirm that my Planet X model, a 10th planet beyond Pluto, would come around in the same type of apogee. And what's really interesting is that Dr. Harrington's research really was one of the first to show that based on the outer planets, there's a perturbation, some type of pull being exerted by the outer planets in a certain direction, which led them to think there must be some other large body out there. Now, they don't look for extrasolar planets using that mind frame anymore. It's using more advanced solar and you know, radio waves being able to be generated in space to, you know, look at high temperatures and cold temperatures and discern mass. But it's just very interesting research that we have, even to this day, discussions for a planet that would be something that size, 4 to 8 times the size of Earth. And if that is ever discovered, then yes, it's possible that we might have ancestors on that planet.
Well, why is it, though, that whenever I ask an astronomer about Nibiru or the possibilities, they all seem to poo it away? They don't agree with it.
One reason is because they think the conditions have to be absolutely perfect for life to thrive. But there is a possibility, like life on Earth, according to these stories, life had help to thrive and survive. The Anunnaki themselves may have had help.
Right, the Anunnaki coming here is a good point. Is, you know, if the Anunnaki genetically created us in their image and after their likeness, well, the Anunnaki just have to be gods with the small g. Someone had to have created the Anunnaki.
Right.
And so then a scientist would have trouble because now you're attributing it to something that he cannot test.
Well, it's almost like the old movie Contact, where,
right,
you know, the alien mentions that, you know, they didn't build the apparatus. Somebody gave it to them. It seems like it goes on forever.
The universe is now dated somewhere between 15 to 16 billion years old, based on the position of certain quasars and the oldest part of space photographed by the Hubble Space Telescope. Our solar system is somewhere between 4 and 5 billion years old, maybe up to 5.5 or 6. We are Johnny-come-lately in this universe.
Yeah, we are.
I mean, and imagine a civilization that is 500,000 years ahead of us. Now, the Anunnaki were on Earth around 450,000 years ago or so. They developed space travel probably just right before that. Half a million years in the span of several billion means they only beat us by a snap of a finger. They just beat us before we were able to get into space. On an evolutionary timescale, that's very small.
Yeah, but it was enough of a snap to put them way ahead of us.
That's correct, and they may have had help.
Well, they definitely helped us. I mean, again, some of those phrases that we were looking at, like that sacred number 12, as you said, the 12 tribes of Israel, 12 disciples of Jesus, on and on, all the way down to the 12 Anunnaki. Interestingly enough, when we look at the 12 planets in our solar system, everyone assumes that that term, third rock from the sun, you know, Earth is the third planet, when in fact the Anunnaki said that we were on the seventh planet, Ki, the sacred number 7, 7 days in a week, 7 tablets of creation, mm-hmm. and counting from coming into our solar system, meaning if you were to pass by Pluto and count Pluto, Uranus, Neptune, Saturn, Jupiter, Mars, Earth is the seventh planet. So coming outward in, we're actually on the seventh planet, and that's what the Anunnaki prognosticated, was that Earth was the seventh planet. They actually showed signs for Mars being the sixth planet and communication of how they used Mars as a way station to transport gold when it was being mined, as a way station to transport it between Earth and Nibiru.
Mm-hmm. The evidence for what Jason is talking about is actually contained on the planisphere disc that we referenced before, held in the British Museum, where it actually tells the story of their god Enlil leading his people past the planets. And they have the dots, the 7 dots, showing the planets that they passed by. And the planisphere has a lot of other astronomical type of navigation information on it. It is my favorite piece in the world, actually.
Or alongside the other tablet, another Sumerian amazing artifact that shows, as a backdrop to the cylinder seal, mm-hmm. a complete model of our solar system, which the most important point of this is that the sun is in the center. Till the time of Copernicus and Galileo, we thought Earth was the center of the universe. We're here, in fact, on a 4,500-year-old, tablet. Thank you. We have, you know, a depiction of an accurate solar system that does include all the planets that we know of, with an additional planet, Nibiru.
Did we lose any artifacts during the Iraqi invasion?
That's a great question. I'd start off by answering that and saying that, yes, there's definitely been some losses there. When we went in the second round, there was, first of all, some anomalous activity, and two, just outright destruction, you know, that happens through war.
Oh, yeah.
The anomalous activity was reported that we have several sacred artifacts stored in the Iraqi museum that were removed with coordinated procedures, meaning it wasn't like someone busted a window and stole an artifact.
They knew what they wanted to get.
Right, and they had, like, you know, earpieces and keys to locks and doors that just weren't given out to anyone. And sacred relics of the actual original forms of these were stolen.
But
so,
fortunately, those pieces were all documented, photographed, and recorded.
Yes.
We don't know if there was something that was not published, we wouldn't know that.
Well, you know, let me throw out there one little juicy point from the ufology side, is that, you know, around that time there was a lot of information, because Saddam was just captured in that same time frame. There was a lot of information that came out that actually Saddam Hussein had a lot of interest in the Anunnaki and had actually contacted the British Museum. A lot of the artifacts, the originals, are stored in the British Museum, mm-hmm. and the Iraq Museum just had replicas, which seems
odd. They wanted the originals back, though.
That's correct.
Yeah.
They made several requests under the auspices that Saddam wanted to make, like, an Anunnaki theme park was one of the rumors, where he wanted to have lots of the artifacts on display, you know, attributing to the Anunnaki.
Well, he was rebuilding Babylon, wasn't he?
Something like that.
Yeah. He thought of himself as, you know, one of these, what do you call it, reincarnated old Nebuchadnezzar.
Yeah, he was rebuilding the Tower of Babel.
He was trying to.
So there was a rumor that possibly the Saddam regime had gotten their hands on some type of alien technology, and we went in there basically to shut him down from that, not to, you know, nuclear weapons or oil. It was basically, that was one of the rumors on the ufology side, was that they had gotten their hands on some technology
an Iraqi Roswell event, if you will, and we didn't want them to get to any type of threat of level of technology that the U.S. currently has as far as, you know, advanced weapons.
One of my past guests claims that he was wearing some kind of a necklace that gave him very strange mystical powers,
right,
to the point where he felt invincible.
Well, we didn't get him in the first Iraqi war, and the reason was told that he was basically hiding in one of the ziggurat pyramids that for archaeological significance we couldn't bomb. But in the second round, you know, there were definitely monuments and wall reliefs that, you know, go back thousands of years showing, you know, wall reliefs of Anunnaki and fascinations for our topic that were severely damaged or ruined. So it really is, as Eric pointed out, great that we have most of these stored in digital form. And I was lucky enough with a professional antiquities photographer to get into the Louvre and the British Museum and film all of these, which, you know, I now store on the website, so that at least there's a digital record that will preserve these. God knows what will happen as things progress that, you know, we might lose the actual pieces.
Well, and some of these relics must be sitting in some billionaire's family room somewhere.
They did show up on eBay there briefly.
Did they really?
Yeah, there was a huge crackdown.
The real things? The authentic ones?
Yeah, there was a huge crackdown on some of these artifacts showing up on eBay.
God.
You know, not really large items, but I believe it was like a dagger and a necklace, but very expensive.
The obvious things that were stolen from the museum.
I would appear so, yes.
All right, when we come back, we're going to open up the phone lines. We're going to take your phone calls with our two special guests, Jason Martell, Eric Parker. So get ready. Their websites are linked up also at coasttocoastam.com. We'll be right back. And welcome back with Jason Martell and Mr. Eric Parker. As we move along, we'll take your phone calls this hour as well. Gentlemen, you, Jason, of course, you've done some work on the pyramid at Chichen Itza and some other different areas of South America and Central America. What do you think was going on there during that period of time?
Well, I think it's basically kind of what we were discussing with the Sumerian, you know, the Sumerian epic is they have the same stories and same artifacts, the same astronomical alignment, not same astronomical alignments, but the same precision towards astronomical alignments in their architecture that really speak of a time when there was some type of technological understanding. When we look at the artifacts coming from Teotihuacan or Pumapunku, as I mentioned earlier. In Pumapunku, there are these stone blocks that have laser. I mean, the only way to describe these is they have to be some type of laser drilled precision, and they didn't have any, you know, tool at that time that's known to make these types of holes. Some of these blocks in Pumapunku have 6 millimeter drilled holes that go all the way through the stone, and there's no way that science today can explain how they did it. Another piece of this is these stones were filled. They had like scoopings removed and two blocks would be put together on a side, and then they would fill these scoop marks with a molten liquid that would then harden into a latch, keeping the two stones in place. And so a lot of this technology, metallurgy and that such, wasn't really attributed to cultures at that time, yet we have clear evidence that shows artifacts and, you know, architecture that utilize technology that we just still don't attribute to where they got it from. If we ask them, they bequeath to us saying, well, this was something taught to us by Kuku Khan or Viracocha.
The ancients always attribute their knowledge and a lot of what they got to their gods. And they don't take credit for a lot of the things. Yet, in the Mesopotamian story, sometimes you do have the king or the emperor taking credit for a battle or building an aqueduct, but not for the basic knowledge that they handed down, that they always attributed to their gods.
All right, let's go to the phones. We'll pick it up by going west of the Rockies. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Good morning, Mr. Norrie.
Good morning to you. Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Eagle River, Alaska. My name's BJ.
Okay, BJ, take it away.
I'm calling because I have a theory that I don't think anyone's considered. And I've heard everything that everyone said, that there's a possibility, given the work of Hutchinson, that perchance there is a 10th planet orbiting on a 3,600-year orbit outside of our system. But I've been researching this personally for at least 10 years now, And I've come to the conclusion that given what the Anunnaki claimed, which was the loss of their atmosphere, that actually Mars is Nibiru. And a friend of mine who is a late conspiracy theorist, she's long since passed away, hypothesized that the asteroid belts of our solar system aren't planet leftovers. They are actually what was left of a planet, the 12th planet, if you go with the Sumerian mathematical system, that was somehow destroyed.
Well, that's all very, very possible. Who wants to take that reaction?
I'll be happy to tackle that one first.
Okay, great.
Okay.
By the research, there's a website named Meta Research, and the gentleman, Dr. Tom Van Flanderen, has a exploded planet hypothesis.
Sure.
And this is another well-known alternative based on more of the Velikovsky thinking. But I think the angle that we're prognosticating is, again, more slanted towards the Sumerian evidence and the actual artifacts that they left. And they were very clear, and Eric can comment on this too, but they, from my perspective, were very clear in not only specifying all the planets we know of, Mars being one of them, and very specifically Nibiru being a planet 4 to 8 times the size of Earth, much larger, and actually was the reason why we have an asteroid belt. It whacked our primitive Earth, creating the asteroid belt. Mm-hmm. You can take it from there, Eric.
The asteroid belt does not have enough matter, if you were to gather it all together, to make a planet by itself. It actually does appear, even from the stories, that Earth was in the position where the asteroid belt was and was bumped. And it probably took along its original moon with it, which is called Kingu in the Enuma Elish, the Epic of Creation. In the Epic of Creation, there is an explanation for a lot of the weird things we see. In the outer solar system, what is it, Uranus, is a magnetic field is sideways. Or it's actually tilted sideways.
Tilted on its side, right?
Venus has a retrograde spin.
Yes.
Most people don't know that.
Yes.
I mean, that is amazing. How the hum that they're not talking about that all the time, that there's a planet that spins in opposite direction from the rest of them. I mean, that's some weird stuff going on. And the Enuma Elish does describe a lot of it, basically, from this invader that brought along with it other debris with it.
All right, let's go back to the phones. West of the Rockies, you're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hi, this is John from Bonnie Lake, Washington.
Hello, John. Thanks.
Yes. The blue-eyed Quakadan?
Kukukan, Viracocha,
yeah,
yes.
Kukukan, I'm sorry.
Kukukan, it's okay.
Okay. Well, the Bible says that Satan, and you're aware of this, comes as an angel of light. Now, the Mayans were looking for him, if I understand you correctly, to return in 1519 again.
They prophesied and hoped.
Okay. They prophesied it. Instead, they got Cortez, right?
Right.
In the name of, was it Queen Isabella?
The conquistadors?
Yes.
Well, they were aggressively converting to Christianity, yes.
I understand that. And so in the name of God and their queen, they came and destroyed them.
Mm-hmm.
It would be just like an angel of light coming in wolf's clothing to come back and to destroy those that he came to begin with.
So what would your question be on that point then, sir?
Well, that in fact that the Bible says that in the last days that men would turn to myths and that like the Samaritan writings. Okay. We're assuming that they were the predecessors to the Bible. Okay, so now God says to Daniel through Michael the archangel after 21 days of prayer that he was to seal up the book and the vision because at the last days these things would be revealed. Now, God could use the ancient texts that were given prior to the Bible as a part of that process. You get my meaning?
I understand your position. And
the Word of God is the Word of God.
When you say the Word of God, you're talking about the New Testament. Which is the book that you, when you say, what I'd like to know is what is the actual term for the, what name of God do they use in the Daniel story? Do you know what you're referring to?
Yes, referring to God, the Jehovah God, or the one that, the God that's told Moses to tell him that I am, is coming.
Mm-hmm. You remember the birth story of Moses?
Yes, I do.
But what was unique about it, how he was born in private and put in a basket, right?
Yes.
and left to float and then found by noble person and raised to be the king, in this case of the Israelites, or the leader. Well, that birth story was borrowed from a king called Sargon of the Akkadian Empire, Sargon the Great, king of Akkadia, who was also born in secret, put into a basket and sealed with pitch and float in the river until he was found by
Moses,
a noble person.
But Moses lived, and it's written in Egyptian text.
Yeah, but then why would they borrow his birth story from a 1,500-year or 1,000-year-old story?
Because Satan, the angel of light, knew what the story was going to be, and he wanted to cloud the issue.
The author of the book you're referring to now is Satan?
The author of the text prior to the Bible could very well be his pre-knowledge of those same events.
You see,
he would, to blind us in the last days, use these texts against us and against the Word of God. And the Bible makes it very clear that the door is Christ, and that we must go through Jehovah God. We cannot go through the ancient text.
Which book are you quoting from now, when you just said that?
Well, from the New Testament.
Which book of the New Testament? Which author are you referring to?
Well, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, because they all said the same thing.
Well, actually, no, they didn't.
Well, they actually did have variations in their stories, but they were only compounding upon stories that were given by their predecessor. In other words, Mark wrote about a certain part, and then Matthew wrote about a certain part.
Well, the problem is very simple. When you look for copies of documents and texts that have survived for thousands of years,
mm-hmm.
and in the case of the New Testament, they are all in parchment form. They were originally translated by the members of their community who were knowledgeable and knew how to read, write, and do all that. But a lot of them had mistakes, and the problem is that when you look over the historical record of all the mistakes, the meanings get slurred. Now, when we are looking thousands of years before that, before the Bible, there was even an impetus to talk about a single God. Before Abraham had his revelation of a single God, there was no concept of that yet. There was several thousand years of civilization that recorded everything that they knew on clay or stone, which hasn't been changed since they wrote it. So we know what they talked about.
Boy, Eric, I bet if we could find a time machine, I know what era you'd go back to.
You got that right.
Yeah.
So all I'm saying is that you're quoting from stuff that borrowed from stuff earlier. And all the stories that you're familiar with existed before, like the birth story of Moses, for example. Another one is the first plague of Egypt with the river turning to blood. That was done by Inanna Ishtar first, thousands of years earlier.
But there's a picture of Ishtar also on Coast to Coast AM. I'll throw in there real quickly.
Okay. So those borrowed stories are all over the Old Testament before the New Testament even comes into play.
All right, let's go to our first-time caller line. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi there. This is Kelly from Chatsworth.
Sure. Chatsworth, California,
yeah, hey.
By the way.
Yes, and George, they should strike coins with your portrait on them. Anyways, I just wanted to comment. I'm a collector of cylinder seals and cuneiform, and I've done that my entire life. My grandfather left me a large collection, and I continue it. And about the, you know, on eBay, what happened after the Iraq War was mostly people trying to capitalize on the you know, what was in the news and in the media.
I see.
And, of course, what was unfortunate was the museum was looted due to the need to make money. It's a poor country. But on eBay quickly overcorrected the other direction, and a lot of legitimate pieces from great old provenance collections were all yanked off, and we were vilified, basically, by eBay as, you know, looters and criminals when we had pieces that had beautiful pedigrees, like Christie's, 1930s, and stuff like that.
Callie, do you believe the stories that the museum employees actually hid the items?
Yeah, I have several friends in Iraq that some employees hid them because they loved them so much. Some hid them hoping to sell them. Mm-hmm. Some hid them. I mean, you can probably say that almost everything happened. Secret things were taken because they had value to other people, and it was an opportunity that they could get them. There was a lot of interesting things going on about that I heard. But
I'm sorry, go ahead, please.
Oh, as far as pieces coming out, a lot of stuff did come out of the market because they were able to get people, families who had found things, could get them out of the country and through Jordan and things like that. And most of us as collectors just sort of just stayed with, like, you know, I needed a provenance or I'm not buying it type of thing.
Right.
I'll take a rollout and, you know, and take home the clay with the rollout, but I'm not taking the seal. That sort of thing happened just so we didn't have our collections compromised by any bad material.
Caller, if you're at all interested, I'd love to speak with you offline. And if you could email me at jason@xfax.com.
Jason@xfax.com.
Or send me an email at sitchin.com, eric@sitchin.com.
Yeah, we'd love to discuss more with you if you're a private collector of some of the seals.
No problem. I have a big cassite seal around my neck. I wear it to bed all the time. But I wanted to say, George, you have a great show, and I love you for it.
Thank you so much for being part of the program. Let's go to our wild card line. You're up on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, George. Thank you. This is Tom in Los Angeles.
Hey, Tom. Thank you.
Either one of your guests, they claim or they believe that we were put on this earth by another race. Am I right in that? The stitching also?
No, not completely correct. What happened was there was the genetic hominids already on earth. All the Anunnaki did in the story, which is the same as the biblical story, is they matched and mixed the DNA together with theirs, and then created an advanced being that jumped ahead on evolution. So they did not create anything from zero. There was an existing hominid on Earth.
Were the different races here at that time, or did they genetically make the different races, and if so, by why?
They did have, I don't know about the different races. There was mistakes made that they recorded and reported and showed some depictions of when some of the experiments went incorrectly. But after they made the model, Adam.
They made? You said they made?
What I'm saying is the Anunnaki. It's described in the stories. When the creation process is described, it's a trial and error process. This is not just where magically something appears. They go through a process of figuring out how to do it and what they should do.
Would you think that maybe those people, if they did exist, were the fallen angels?
Well, here's the thing. The fallen angel terms comes from the Hebrew root nephilim, which is fallen ones, if you take it from the verb nafal in Hebrew, which means to fall. But there's also in Aramaic, the word for the fallen one, nephila, is also the word for giant. The name Anunnaki, the god in Hebrew, becomes the word for giant. What you have is the fallen one is simply one way of translating the word that described these beings. So Anunnaki means those who from heaven came down to earth. The word Nephilim means those who have fallen down from above down to below. So fallen angels is really a misinterpretation of the description of these characters who show up in the Bible, by the way.
Yeah. What about all the different animals? Were they all here when these people started doing their tricks?
Well, the animals that we have on earth would be from evolution on the natural process on earth. They don't talk about creating animals except for some mistakes they had where humans came out looking like something funny like an animal. But they did not participate in creating animals.
But you're saying there was human beings on Earth when they came.
That's correct.
Okay.
But back then they describe us as living like animals in the field, drinking from the rivers, and not wearing any clothes.
I still can't find it. When this subject comes up on George's show and other shows, I just still can't get any answer about the races.
The races is a tough one.
I'll make one comment on that. Mm-hmm. Just in the same time frame of the Sumerian epic, you know, on another continent, we have the Mayan culture, which we've been discussing, and their god, which did not look anything like them, they said was, you know, a white-skinned, blue-eyed, long, flowing white hair. So there's a lot of similarities again from the Sumerians and the Mayans to the Egyptians, where all these cultures around that time frame speak of their gods and the impartation the gods left them, whether it be in the creation myths or actual, you know, building of some of these structures.
Okay, well, when we come back, we'll take final phone calls right here on coasttocoastam.com. If you need to email me, that's george@coasttocoastam.com. Just send me the message. It gets right to me. Some people, I've responded to many, many people, and I've had a few people respond back to me saying, is this really you? I say, yeah, it's me. Nobody else looks at the emails. It comes straight to me. So I'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Final phone calls with our two special guests, Jason Martell, Mr. Eric Parker, on Coast to Coast AM. Eric, there is no doubt about it. The Sumerians were expert astronomers, weren't they?
That's correct. They had knowledge of precession that was even well beyond anything that we could comprehend for that period of time. There was a tablet, George, that had a unbelievable number on it, 12,960,000, and it divided it all the way down till there was nothing left by their sexagesimal system. So they basically divided everything that's in the precession, and they came up with the 25,920 years for the full yearsly cycle of the precession. Well, obviously, they didn't figure it out on their own. Somebody had to, you know, give them the information and told them what to write down.
Somebody jump-started them.
And they attributed to it. Even the Assyrian king Ashur Banipal didn't take credit for this one.
All right, let's go back to the phones. We'll pick it up by going to our East of the Rockies line. You're on Coast to Coast. Good morning. Hello?
Is anybody out there?
Well,
hello?
Are you there? Nope, goodbye.
Maybe they fell asleep.
Let's go to the West of the Rockies line. Nobody will sleep with you two on. Hi there.
Hi. Yeah. I had a question for your guest.
Sure.
It was concerning, the Dogon and the Sensi seeds and sort of take they had on the Dogon and their legends of Sensi seeds and also how they came from Cyrus or in their ancient legends. And also what they think is under the right paw of the Sphinx in that unearthed chamber there, what they think could be there.
Eric, do you mind if I take the chamber under the paw?
Do not
part
mind.
Of that one.
Go ahead.
I'll let Eric tackle the Dogon part of that. The chamber under the Sphinx, there's speculation that there's some type of chamber under there. I know they found the tomb of Osiris looking under the Sphinx. But the only thing I would answer to your question, caller, is that the director of antiquities for the Giza Plateau, Zahi Hawass, which I have nothing against Zahi, but will always rigorously hold to anything being found in Egypt was built by the Egyptians.
Right, he won't budge.
But there has been evidence on many levels, one being that the pyramids are aligned with the Orion constellation in 10,500 BC, and two, that there has been secret tunneling in passageways, that they did actually show a secret tunnel in the Great Pyramid where there's a door with little copper rods stopping it. Now, they finally, on air, Zahi Hawass let camera crews in, and they drill a hole in this little door, and they show you a little room behind the door, and they say, oh, there's nothing in there. But this isn't what actually took place. There's something else that happened off camera before they actually showed it on film. So my answer to you is if there's something under the paw, you're not going to see it on TV.
Mm-hmm. Okay,
not
thanks.
On the Discovery Channel.
Well, right. They'll probably show you something, but it's not going to be more than likely what the actual contents really were.
When's the last time we saw something from an official archaeologist who discovered something that was actually opposite what they've always thought was correct?
Yeah, exactly. First time caller line, you're on the air. Hi there.
Yes, so my question is for your guest.
Sure.
Yes. Wasn't it so that there were 10 months in the calendar year prior to one of the Caesar adding 2 months to making it 12 today?
No, that's actually not correct. The renaming of the months did happen by the Roman emperors, of course. But I've got a book here from a professor from the British Academy, who actually documented the origin of the calendar.
Okay.
And how they described every month. And what happened was when the calendar was described, they also described what was good days and bad days.
Hmm.
And then they had all these things that eventually became the holidays that we all know about today.
Oh, okay. Well, now, October, that would have been the eighth month at one time, right?
That's right.
Oh, okay. The Arantia, does this have anything in it? I know it was written in the 50s, I believe.
The only problem with the Urantia book is the documenting evidence of the origin of it.
Oh.
You see, the problem is that anything that comes after a certain point
right.
is going to borrow on everything that came before.
Well, true, like you were saying all evening. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Bye.
All right, appreciate you being part of the program. Next up, East of the Rockies, you're up with us. Hi there. Hello?
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead, sir.
And then the other one is about the Gilgamesh epic in Babylon, and then you got the stanzas of the Dazians in Tibet and the Pope Avul in the Mayas.
Correct.
And these all occur in the same time frame in the 3000 BC.
Correct.
And they all mention the same things about nuclear war that went on at that time.
An evil wind that passed over the lands?
Yep.
Causing elephants to spark right into flames?
One would think it would be a nuclear war or something.
Well, a nuclear explosion, maybe not. I mean, maybe a single occurrence.
Maybe a hit by an asteroid?
No, well, we have that evidence. Debris from the asteroid, but there is evidence of some weird things in the Middle East, in the desert. Was it Sinai? We had a researcher that went and did some research for Zechariah, presented it at a conference a few years ago.
It's glass, right? Under the sand was glass?
They did find evidence of superheated stones in areas that had weird heating episodes, and they were isolated. And there's no volcanic activity to explain it. There isn't any volcanoes over there.
Let's go to our wild card line. You're up on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi there. This is George over in Pittsburgh.
George, go ahead.
Hey, George. Hey, you'd mentioned about the astronomers of South America seeing the sun and then this cross coming in, which could be Nibiru coming into us. And if that was coming in, that elliptical of that crossing our elliptical would be like a stylus that would cross our planet. And if it's big enough, the mass should affect the tidal wave of the mountain chains. And if I look at the mountain chains, if I stand back on our planet on the south and the Himalayas, it looks like a stylus or a sine wave. Using modern computer math, I might be able to predict the size of that planet and its weight on the basis of how it pulled up the mountains and have a time frame because it should be etched in the stones. What do you think?
Well, are you going to attribute the mountain size, range, and scope to a passing of a planet every 3,600 years as opposed to the natural processes that are on the Earth?
Well, it's like a sine wave, meaning that it's more like something went across the planet and pulled them up versus just tectonic plates of floating, you see.
But how can you document the occurrence, the time occurrence of when these things happened?
The base of the mountain, in the stones, your magnetic anomalies and the events that are written in the stones in a way of animals or whatever's there, you see. But it sure looks like a strong force come across and pulled up the tidal wave, same as the moon pulls our oceans, pulls that up, and it comes across as if that planet may match our elliptical as we go alongside, or we catch up to it as it comes through, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought that'd be a great idea if someone would use computer math, and they might be able to do a lot of predicting.
Well, if you feel strongly about it, you should go pursue it.
That's an interesting point. It's just it's really hard at this point to attribute that to an extrasolar or, you know, a body outside of Earth, which, like in Eric's point, it's, you know, there's processes here on Earth, which we can't account for that. I think your point is interesting, caller. It's just it's not something easily quantifiable as saying a planet which we haven't even found yet is the cause of this.
Right. Could that planet be affecting Earth's mountains more than Jupiter and Saturn, which are always there, and the moon and other things that pull on us?
Let's go west of the Rockies. You're on Coast to Coast.
Hello.
Hello.
Oh, hi. This is Dan in Hollywood.
What's up, Dan?
Hey, Dan.
I've been listening to you, and I'm just wondering, it sounds like perhaps you rebuke Abraham, Moses, Jesus, and I'm just wondering, do you worship many gods, and do you worship idols?
No, not at all. In fact, if you research where Abraham came from, which was Ur, and his father and grandfather were priests in Sumeria, and you remember there may be a story that some people remember of him destroying idols. Abraham is the extension of the Sumerian civilization, which eventually did get destroyed. Jason mentioned the evil wind. The evil wind did come. There's tablets that lament about it. They killed all the people, but the buildings were left standing. So Abraham and that story actually continues where the Sumerian civilization is destroyed. And the question is, who was contacting Abraham? Who told them to leave and to go to Haran and leave the Tigris and Euphrates? That's where civilization was always. Eventually, his journey went all the way as far as Egypt. Abraham did get into Egypt and then back to the Israelite and the Palestinian land. So it just continues the story.
Couple more minutes to go. Wildcard line, you're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hello, George.
Yeah.
My question for your guests is, how do they explain the Epic of Gilgamesh and who he was, and if he has any references in the modern-day Bible, the Old Testament?
You want me to go with that one, Jason?
Sure.
Well, Gilgamesh is an interesting character. It's the oldest literary tale that we have a complete record for. It's 16 tablets. Gilgamesh searches for immortality. Along the way, he meets many characters, picks up some friends, and has an adventure. He claimed that he was two-thirds divine, that one-third was human, his father, and his mother was a goddess, Ninsun, and he was therefore two-thirds divine. And we translate that into thinking that the DNA of the mother is more important in the makeup of the child than the father's DNA. He eventually, by the way, does reach some kind of plant that gives him immortality, but guess what? A snake comes out of a river and grabs it away and steals the gift of immortality away from mankind, just like it happened in the Garden of Eden. The snake gave Eve the impetus to have eat the fruit, the forbidden fruit, and then they lost the ability to have immortality. That's what happened with Gilgamesh as well.
Okay, so you're making him out to be the modern-day Adam?
No, Gilgamesh is... No, I wouldn't say he's the modern-day Adam. The Adam and Eve story, the first man and first woman, comes from the Adama of the created. When they created the humans, they named them what the Bible eventually picks up the name if you just throw an accent on it. Okay, so Gilgamesh is actually the first character that we think of as a hybrid being or claiming to be hybrid. Also, the motif that he creates, he has a battle where he fights two lions, and he's in the middle with two lions, and he's holding them up in the air. If you ever see that motif, it goes all the way back to Gilgamesh, which is 3500 BC. So this story has all these other things. He meets the hero of the flood. We hear the flood story in Gilgamesh. It covers so many different versions of things that we find out later on that come into the Bible, and any type of, even the, he even sees, he at least sees a rocket ship taking off and describes it. There's a lot of things going on in Gilgamesh.
First time caller line, you're up with us on Coast to Coast. Hello there.
Hello.
Yeah, go ahead. Where are you calling from?
Huntington, West Virginia.
Okay, sir, go ahead.
You have to forgive my voice. I'm coming down with pneumonia.
You're coming down with pneumonia? And you're devoted for calling the program.
I've been trying for weeks. This is very interesting. You said they were trying to rebuild the planet, or at least prolong their existence. I don't know how you would say that, by using gold, correct?
Right.
Okay. And in the biblical, they say that the heaven of, the religious way is lined with streets of gold. Does that have anything to do with the tablets or a derivative from that?
Can you tell me what book that's from?
It's Revelations. And Matthew, a couple other books, Psalms.
The reference to the gold lining is... In several books, you're saying?
Yes.
I did not see that before.
Well, it depends, because there are a lot of different translations. Your King James, then the Jehovah's Witnesses, they have the New World Translation, whatnot. And they all translate it differently.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm not really sure how to answer that caller, other than saying that, yes, the Anunnaki and their story is based around their need for putting fine particulates of gold into their atmosphere, because they said... Gold used as an insulator would help protect their atmosphere and insulate the heat needed to keep them alive. And we know today that gold is used in the linings of astronaut visors and of that sort as a good insulator.
Yeah.
I would make this... go ahead. Sorry.
I was wondering about that simply because, like you said, all right, if they were to come back at any other given time and something were to happen as far as us, maybe transcending to Planet X, maybe a group of people moving on to, as another planet, maybe as another one being inhabitable or so forth, that maybe it could be such as hope or a word spread through, maybe to give hope for future, time.
Well, even. If the past repeats itself, then maybe the teachers from the sky will come and help us get through our current problems. But moving off planet, I just don't see it. They would probably try to make their children's home, a better place.
You know, we're getting still lots of reports of these alien grays that are coming down to the planet. Obviously, the Anunnaki, they were a different type. Why haven't they come back, or have they?
The gray aliens? Or
no, the Anunnaki.
Well, one thing I'll throw out there is that there are many Sumerian figurines that have a very strong resemblance to the modern-day gray aliens.
True.
And there are texts, which I've heard Zacharias speak of in his lectures, of instructions and a Sumerian would give to one of these beings to decipher whether it was living or not. And it's just a very interesting similarity of these Sumerian figurine statues having very bulbous, oversized heads, large eyes in some of them, with just a similarity to what the grays look like.
They're actually described as a robotic-type being that they could program. It had medical knowledge, and it was sent like on an assignment. They didn't treat it in the text like another Anunnaki normal. It was, they were obviously, so if they could create us, then they may have created other type of beings or modified. That's more like what they seem that they are.
And it seems possible that if they could, you know, create us in their image and after their likeness, mm-hmm. why not create another overseer or watcher race, you know, maybe a hybridization of them and the grays, but
sure.
they, you know, just to keep an eye on us and relay back to the Anunnaki what's going on. And I'm hypothesizing, but if we look at abduction scenarios, it's medical, reproductive analysis. What are they doing with that information? Maybe they're passing it on to their forefathers.
Well, if they made us in their own image, that probably also explains why we are warmongers.
Well, that's true, but they also created that pattern of behavior by leading us into wars, so we started to fight in the name of the god, the local god at the time, who was fighting his sibling, as those sibling rivalries we mentioned, for supremacy on Earth, who was going to control more city-states. And the rivalries continued until Marduk in Babylon dominated.
Eric, how is Zechariah's health these days?
He's doing pretty good. We just had a reunion in New York, which was very successful. It was celebrating the 30th year of 12th Planet, and it's in its 45th printing now.
Isn't that amazing?
It's been also translated over 23 languages.
And he is not backed down in his belief systems about his interpretation of these tablets, has he?
No, he hasn't. In fact, he has a new book coming out titled The End of Days. He's going to discuss some of the end-of-day prophecies that he's discovered with all his years of research.
And does he believe we are very close to that period?
Well, you see, the day, end of days, or the day of the Lord and the day of the return, it's all wrapped up in mythological stories, you know. Is it the end? Is it not the end? It's hard to say.
All right. Really, very good. Eric and Jason, thanks for being on the show.
Thank you, George.
It.
Thank you.
Take care of yourself, gentlemen. We'll do this again next time. For Steve Carr, Dan Galanti, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesour, Ross Mitchell, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell. I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, we'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.